I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca, groundbreaking documentary series that's about to debut on the Knowledge Network and online at knowledge.ca's Living in Hope. It's a culmination of more than a year of filming at North Vancouver's Hope Center. Melanie Wood joins me now. She is the series creator, producer, and director. It's rather outstanding in how she and her crew are able to document the lives of the patients at their most vulnerable. We get a sense of their illnesses and their treatment, but also an idea as to the challenges they face in society outside of Hope, but as well as how mental illness and substance abuse disorder are depicted in the media, that's garnering an unnecessary stigma from society. The film features patients who are creative and sometimes hilarious. They're humans with dignity that's captured so well in the series. I'll get Melanie to tell us about the genesis of the series as well as the people they're in, not just the patients, but the tireless care providers, doctors and nurses and others that give so much of themselves through their work. Melanie Wood's work include the documentary School of Secrets, Liberia 77, and Shut Up and Say Something. She was first on this program in 2013, just as her documentary Fonzie's Corner on Fonzie Police, the famed Vancouver street photographer, was to debut on Knowledge. Living in Hope begins Tuesday, the 6th of November, and will run every Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. until the 27th. There are four episodes, and they'll all be available for streaming at knowledge.ca. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program, Melanie Wood. Ms. Wood, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm doing very well, thanks.
So as I was telling you before we started, many congratulations on this very fine series. It's so good that I'm going to do what I suggest everyone do, and that's watch us every Tuesday night on Knowledge. And the great thing about Knowledge is that if you if you're not near a television, you can stream it, right?
Yes, you can. Knowledge.ca, very easy to remember. And, stream at your convenience, which is great.
Yeah.
And it will also be live on that site as we go to air as well.
I see, yeah. So I'm watching the series, and one realizes as they're watching Living in Hope just how prevalent mental illness is around us, and how a lot of the patients in the film are just like us, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they are, absolutely. And, you know, that was a thing, that was one of the things that surprised me. I mean, obviously not all of us will get a mental illness, but I think almost all of us have been touched by it somewhere close to us, either friend or family member, and we just don't talk about it. I was shocked to find out that, yeah, in fact, even in my own family, it's not something, I mean, I guess it just isn't something you raise when you're having a dinner table conversation. But I hope that we get better at not being afraid to talk about it if someone needs to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like having any other condition, you know, whether you have, say, diabetes or cancer. I mean, even cancer, I mean, that's something that a lot of people are reticent to talk about as it is. But you know, if you look at all of these things together, we're doing a lot better now than, say, 25 years ago, right, or longer.
Well, I guess we are. I think one of the things that I'm finding is that, and I think all the campaigns are fantastic, don't get me wrong, but some of the bigger campaigns, I guess in order to be accepted, have people in the campaigns who say, yes, I have a mental illness, but they're all people, when they speak to us, the public, are in a point in their illness where they don't look or act mentally ill. Their illness isn't showing, and they've accomplished something great. Sometimes they're Olympic athletes or whatever, hockey players, and you think, okay, it's great those people are speaking out, but what about all the rest of the people who don't have anyone to stand up for them, who don't look that beautiful and haven't accomplished that much? How do they feel about their own problems with mental health if they're holding themselves up to that? It'd be like me saying, wow, I want to play the piano like some great piano player, only I've never played a piano in my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a hard bar.
Yeah.
So I think the more we can just accept people in whatever phase of illness or wellness they're in, mentally or physically, the more we can just see people as people, I think the better off we'll all be.
So I'll be fascinated to talk to you in a moment about the process that you undertook in terms of filming these patients and their care providers. But this facility, the Hope Center, and it's spelled capital H-O and then P-E. Why is it like that?
Because it is actually, I don't know if I can get it all right, the Robert and Greta H.N. Ho Psychiatric and Education Center.
So it's a wonderful homage for them, right?
It is. The whole family themselves have had some people in their family who've had to work through mental illness, and they were kind enough to donate a big chunk of change to that Lionsgate Hospital Foundation in order to get the center built. And everyone over there, the building itself, I can't forget to talk about it, because just the fact that there was a purpose-built facility to help people get mentally well and retain their whatever level of wellness they can have is something fairly new. I mean, now you see it in more places, but at the time, usually the psychiatric wings of any hospital or institution were in the back or basement, dark, never built for that, always just ad hoc. And it really says something to people who were trying to treat about whether or not they deserve to get well. If they're in a back room without windows, they don't feel that good about themselves. And I forget the actual stats for Hope Center, but when it opened and patients transferred, within that first year they were tracking, and they used, I think it's around 60% less interventions were used for the patients in order to make them well. So it just the building itself said, we care about you, we think you count, it's worth having a window in your room, because we'd all want a window in our room.
Yeah.
So the building itself has made a huge difference.
Yeah, it's a first-class facility, and it looks nice when you see it in your film. A lot of windows, and even the way that they build, say, I don't know what you call it, the nursing station, I guess, it's surrounded by windows so they can see everything around them.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, there's a moment in the first episode where they're talking about wherever they dispense the medicines out of, how that should be refashioned, just because it would be better functional that way. And then they're getting advice from the people that work there, the people that use it every day, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, everyone, they call it the team station now. I was calling it the nursing station because that's old language.
Yeah,
but they call it a team station because there are also social workers in there and other therapists who come in and out, and the doctors, of course. So they do work as a team and really try to answer to concerns, and when incidents happen, they adjust. So it's very much kind of an ongoing changing facility, trying to do the best they can to help people who need the help. And that's what intrigued me. So, yes, at one point in one of the films, there's an incident at the medication window. It was early on in my filming, and over the course of the year I was there, they came to a different way of dispensing medicine, which is to actually come to the door, open the door, and either go out and give it to the patient or give it to them at the doorway instead of through that little window. So it was interesting to see the transformation in that, even just the amount of time I was there. It's great.
Yeah. So tell us about the sort of patients that go through the Hope Center, and how long on average are their stays? Because in the course of the series, people do come back, don't they?
They do. It is... the whole building is a center that helps everybody in the community, outpatients as well, what I call outpatients, community people, clients. But up on the fourth floor of the center is the acute care facility, and that's what it's for, is people, when they're in crisis, come in either through emergency or through family or their team worker, if it's deemed necessary. And they get kind of settled down and rebalanced and then sent back to whatever care they need in the community. So through that, acute care is supposed to be 10 days to 2 weeks. And often it was even shorter than that, which was great to see. But there are also some people there, like one of my favorite people to work with, his name was Richard, and he really just kind of started to view it as home, and the team was desperately trying to get him out because it really isn't a place to live. It's a place to get stabilized and move back to living arrangements. But and then, of course, people do go out and come back. You know, they go back to whatever community they're in and somehow destabilize again, and it's just this flow. If you're a person often living with a mental illness, it takes stabilization every once in a while. So for the most part, you can do well, hold down a job, live in your own place or with family or in a group home, and then every once in a while, you destabilize to the point where you need that little bit of extra tweaking, and back in you go. So, you know, I don't think that's a mistake. I think that's really just being realistic about the kind of care people need.
Yeah. And so how long did you spend there, Melanie?
Well, I filmed for over a year on and off. I mean, I wasn't there every single day for 365, but really most weeks for over a year. And then I also did some filming in the previous year just to see what was going on. And through that time, we saw quite a bit of change. I mean, in staff, in patients, in the way things operated. I have to say, though, I laugh some days because I find I've continued to be in touch with a lot of the people I film with, of course.
Uh-huh.
And there's some really drastic differences in some of them now, you know, a year and a half later. And I'm thinking, oh, man, wish we'd had that when I was filming.
Right.
But you can't just keep going forever. So, you know, a year really gives you some idea of what it's like to be there and to come and go from there.
So we've talked about the clients, the patients that are there, but I mean, a good part of the film is also the people that provide the care, the doctors, the nurses, and the sort. And you really do illustrate just how demanding their jobs are, how challenging their careers are, and how sometimes, unfortunately, it can get dangerous, right?
Yes. Oh, exactly. I mean, the people who work in Hope Center, for the most part, that I saw were they do amazing work, and they really, truly care about the people that come through there. And it doesn't always feel like that, probably, to the families of those people. You know, I can imagine being a mom and having my son go through and kind of being disappointed with stuff. It's just because, as a mother, you'd be, you know, your whole focus is one person.
Yeah.
They're trying to look after a whole building full of people. But I really think they do an amazing job, and sometimes there is a danger to themselves, but for the most part, I mean, as Zoe told me, she said, you know, you're walking down the street, you can be in danger too. As human beings, we aren't that predictable. So I just think that people who are in the height of some kind of episode mentally are less stable and can be more likely to lash out without meaning to.
Yeah.
So I think as a staff member, you'd certainly, you get trained for some of that, and you have to be hyper-vigilant. And when we were there, me and the two people who I was filming with, we started to see where there were, you know, there'd be someone who was a little tense that day, and you kind of stay away from that part of the building and just keep out of their way. But the staff would actually have to go and deal with them, so.
Yeah, it's a physically demanding job in terms of, I mean, you mentioned Richard, I mean, if he'd fall, someone would have to help him up, and then you, like in the case of Zoe, who's really one of the stars of the series.
I think so too.
Yeah, you can see how it affects her physically when a patient dies, and then there's a beautiful moment where you've captured just how she's processing it and how physical that is, not to mention how emotional she must be going through at that moment.
Oh, exactly. And for all of them, I mean, you know, one nurse I talked to, he's not one of the ones who has a large part in the film, but, you know, someone called him a very nasty name, a patient did on the ward, and it affected him a lot. I mean, some of the training for them is to not take it personally, but sometimes you just do. And so you have to, you know, there has to be space for the care providers to look after themselves as well. And I think that's something that I noted that I have to get better at, especially if I was filming in there. I had to take some time for myself. But, you know, Zoe, who is just so wonderful with everyone, really you know, she does process things, and then I think makes a really good decision about how to move forward with it. And she has to do that in the moment, on the day. She can't go in and think about it for a week like you and me.
Yeah, you learn from watching these people.
Yes.
Just how infinitely patient they are. And you do derive, say, some wisdom in that, don't you, as a viewer?
I think so. I think filming has taught me to be more considerate and more patient. And I thought I was a fairly considerate person. Maybe not so patient all the time. But I did learn a lot, actually. I learned about humor. I mean, there's lots of humor in there.
Yeah, there is, isn't there, yeah.
Yeah, both between patients and between staff members and patients. And I guess I expected on an acute care ward everything to be sort of solemn and somber and everyone to be grumpy. But, you know, it wasn't like that. I mean, there are cranky people, but frankly, there are cranky people wherever I go.
Yeah.
And people could actually settle in and you could get a sense of who they really were as a person if you took the time to get to know them. And that was a real honor for me to be able to do that.
So there's some patients that we see in the series that are unable, because of their illness, they're unable to realize that they're sick or that they're unwell. When you're filming someone in that instance, what are some of the rules, say, around that, especially with consent, because they might not know what's happening with them at that moment?
Right. I was wondering, when you get to consent, it's on everyone's mind. I had a very... a very strict consent process. I mean, just me as a person, I would never want to put anyone's story on that didn't want to be there. That's just who I am. I'm not the kind of journalist that goes in and tries to take advantage. And so to begin with, I had a consent even when they were unwell and not legally able to give consent. I wanted to make sure they signed so I knew they actually wanted to do it. Then when they were later discharged and able legally to give consent, I went back to them and said, you know, are you still okay with this? And if they were, they signed again. If they were never capable of giving consent, some people in there are always, they always have someone else who could sign for them. Then I got either the psychiatrist or their legal guardian to sign. And that would take care of that part of the process. But then again, later, all of the people, all of the main patients in there, got to see what I'd edited of them and what I'd edited of people speaking about them before, and then give consent again for that. And at that point, I felt, okay, they really do know what I captured. They know what I'm using. Everyone knows what a TV set is, sick or not sick, and they know about Knowledge Network. And so all of that went into play, and they'd say yes, and then I feel okay about putting it on air.
So did you have stuff that you shot that we won't be able to see because of, say, the inability to get certain consent at various times during the process?
Yes, but not for... The patients who consented were good with everything I used.
Mm-hmm.
So that part's okay. But there were patients who thought it was going to be okay to be filmed. They wanted to be filmed, and then at a different state in their mental journey, they decided they didn't want to be. So people withdrew. And I expected some of that. I mean, you think different ways at different points on different days.
Yeah.
So, yes, there was some attrition, and there were also some events that happened that I couldn't get permission for because there were too many people in the scene that I didn't have permission to film with. But I think overall I was surprised at how willing people were to share their stories and how good they felt about being asked to share their stories. I mean, people don't ask them to talk.
Yeah.
And so to have a crew come in and say, we actually want to hear what you have to say, they went, wow, really? Really? You want to talk to me? So it was kind of fun in that way to represent them.
Yeah, and so they were, because we see very personal moments in the series, they were at ease eventually with a camera and a mic around them, right?
Yes.
I mean, and I'm just talking about the patients, but the staff themselves.
Yes. You know, for the most part, most people got very comfortable with us. We were just there all the time. We really were embedded and became part of the team in some ways. I mean, obviously, we weren't administering care, but they got used to seeing us around. Everyone did. And then, of course, as patients came through, I would go around reassuring the people who didn't want to be filmed or new people that I would never put them on camera unless they wanted to be. And
yeah.
So there was that constant level of reassurance from me around the ward because, you know, when some people are ill, they really feel a bit paranoid maybe or they keep forgetting that I've told them I'm not going to film with them. So we did a lot of that. And I think the ease with camera is just really because we spent so much time there. But also, I think there were a few people I can think of who didn't want to be filmed for weeks and weeks and weeks and then finally came up to me and said, you know, I've changed my mind. I do want to tell my story. And I think that's partly because they saw that we were really trying to honor the people who wanted to talk to us. We weren't there to get, you know, kind of juicy dirt or anything like that. So we actually had a few people I can think of come up to us later and say, I've changed my mind. I want to be in, which was kind of nice.
And so there are a number of conversations that are filmed that you have with patients. What was that like for you? I mean, because as you said a moment ago, you did get to know them quite well, didn't you?
Yes. Yes. I really enjoyed talking to the patients. And, you know, in lots of ways, I feel like I got to do something that not very many people do. And the staff obviously spends time talking to their patients, but they also have, you know, a whole day's roster full of patients.
Yeah.
So I could actually just be present with one person for as long as it took for that person to feel like they'd been heard. That was my job while I was there. And then we just hang around and talk to them about other things, too. So honestly, my time filming with the patients and the staff was really the best part of the whole process for me. A real surprise, and that the surprising part was that I just loved being there.
Mm.
It was calm. It felt good. You know, I didn't always, some patients didn't want me to be there.
Yeah.
So there was some of that. But as long as I was around the patients who were used to me, it was a good feeling to be there.
Did you get a sense of how they feel, the patients, how they feel we in society writ large, could do better in terms of talking about mental health, say?
You know, yes, it depends on the patient. I think in my understanding of what I was hearing from everyone in there, the patients themselves stigmatize themselves. They feel embarrassed or ashamed of their illness a lot of times. Not everyone, but a lot of people do. And I think because they feel that somehow it's their failure when they're in a certain frame of mind. And that just makes me sad because it certainly isn't their failure. And then I also think a lot of people are embarrassed because for very good reasons that when they go out into the community, if they were to be labeled as having a mental illness or one of those patients from Hope Center or clients, not everyone sees them the same way. You know, you walk in and you're just whoever, you're just Ross and you want to go to the bank, they treat you as Ross. If you walk in and you're Ross and then all of a sudden you go into one of your little phases where your words tumble out the wrong way, everyone freaks out and it's hard for them to look at you as the same person again. So I think everyone really wants there to be a change. I just think it's going to be it's changing. I think we have a long way to go because I see it everywhere. I see it in surprising places, and I see it even from myself when someone says, oh, well, you know, should we talk about this?
Yeah.
I say, well, why wouldn't we? It's what the person does.
Yeah.
Yes, we should talk about it. You know, and people just don't, we're not used to seeing, we, all of us, are not used to seeing someone when they're in the mentally ill state, unless
right.
you're a family member or a close friend, and then it's scary. So it's a hard thing to come to terms with. I really don't, you know, I think you see, as you've been watching, the series doesn't offer solutions. It's not a how-to.
No.
But it does make us all think, I think, about how we act and therefore how we, as a community, can act and change how we feel.
It's a tremendously informative series, as I'm watching it, as you mentioned. You know, I'm learning stuff about how the system works. And I'm learning stuff about these marvelous people and their stories, people that you talk to in the film. But the system itself also, I mean, that's something. I mean, there are a lot of challenges, I guess, with the healthcare system, I mean, this is a great center. I mean, it is a center of hope, isn't it? I mean,
yes,
that there is this beacon in the community.
It is, and you know what? The thing is that people will be listening who have been trying to access care for their friend or loved one for months and been unsuccessful. And so they will be thinking, well, maybe it's a great facility, but how come I can't get my kid in? Or how come I can't get my wife in? And I hear a lot of resentment in the community about any services, not just for Hope Center, but in general.
Yeah.
If people think their person needs help, they can't get them help. And that comes from a lot of places, and I don't think we specifically address that. You just get to hear a few different stories. But we don't have enough facilities. We don't have enough living arrangement facilities. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we all forget is that at the moment, if you're an adult, someone else, it takes a big event for someone to be able to commit you without your say-so.
Yeah.
So it's all very well if I had, you know, my brother, I think, is mentally unwell and I want to get him in. If someone shows up to see if I'm right and he convinces them that he's fine, there's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah.
And that's just the law. And in a way, it would be scary if the law wasn't like that.
Right.
Because that means anyone could commit me any day. I act weird all the time. And so I think people are frustrated when they can't access services. But once they're in that service, I think the service is amazing.
Yeah, and you film the various processes. There's a moment where Ross wants to, I guess he wants to move somewhere else.
Yes.
And it's you know, it is a difficult process. I mean, you know, it's not an easy process to say spring oneself out of a facility, and nor should it be.
No.
But just how rigorous they are about talking about, say, the file. You know, looking at history and say experiences at a previous.
Yeah.
Home or the challenges, you know, financially, because Ross is concerned. Ross thinks he can do it on his own with whatever funds he has, but you know, he's told that he can't.
He can't. No, yeah. That's right, exactly. And so for him, it's a really frustrating process. I don't know if you've ever tried to call a government number and try and access information. I have, and I, you know, that's what I do for a living. That's probably what you do too. And it's almost impossible for me to get through to the right department and get my point across.
Yeah.
So imagine someone who has trouble with, you know, speaking at the moment. I mean, he can get a point across if you're willing to listen, but if you're trying to be a quick civil servant, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
He was so frustrated. And then again, you're right, trying to move houses, and he can't properly articulate why he needs to move from one house.
Yeah.
He says things like, you know, and then oil came along, and you think, whoa, he is nuts. But actually, stopping to think about what he meant was the street in front of his house is busier and busier and busier. There's more and more cars, and they're building a 6-lane highway.
Mm.
So if you really try to get into his brain, you can figure it out. But honestly, it takes months to do that. So he's very frustrated during the process. There is, he's one of the people with a happy ending, in case you just think there's no happy endings.
Yeah.
As you get through the series, you'll figure that out.
Yeah. As I was telling you, I mean, it's such a good series, and I'll be like everybody else watching this Tuesday nights in November. I hate to ask this question because you're talking about this current project, but what's next for you, Melanie?
I haven't had time to think of a next one. You know, often I have another documentary or two in my brain ready to go that I can talk about, but honestly, this has been, because it's been 4 1-hours as part of the project, and I've just been immersed for years now in the project, I'm going to take a little bit of a sabbatical, I think, and just allow myself the rest. That's one of the things I've learned, is that I do need to look after myself as well. I can't do everything all the time. Go figure.
Yeah.
I thought I could. So I don't really have another one coming up soon that I can talk about.
But it's a hell of a good achievement. And, I, you know, when the time comes that you look back at your career, This has got to be. I mean, I was looking at some of the photographs that your publicist sent. You got to meet such remarkable people.
Yes.
And develop these wonderful relationships with him.
Yes.
I mean, that's got to be. I mean, not just worthwhile, but it's made this whole year or more doing this series. I mean, special to it.
Oh. Absolutely. I wouldn't have given this up for anything. I loved what I was doing in it, and I love my connection with the people, and I love my connection with this new community of organizations and associations and facilities that are trying to help people through their mental health journeys. I now feel like I'm part of that in a way, and I feel grateful to have been doing it for sure. Yeah, I look back on it as a very positive experience. I just haven't had the brain width to be able to be creative about another project yet. It will come.
Yeah. Well, until then, I'll look forward to talking to you again. For now, congratulations on this and good luck with it. It's a show that a lot of people need to see, and I think you will find out in very short time. Just how instructive and helpful it'll be for the wider community.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm looking forward to everyone meeting my people, as I call them.
Yeah. Thanks for this, Melanie.
Thank you very much.
Living in Hope premieres Tuesday, the 6th of November at 9 p.m. on the Knowledge Network, as well as online at knowledge.ca. Three subsequent episodes air 9 p.m. on the 13th, 20th, and 27th. Melanie Wood joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.